Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Startup Story. And this is not your normal episode. This week, we will be talking all things related to CPG.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story. And every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning. And every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is The Startup Story.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Startup Story. Before we jump into this week's episode, I have to ask you a single question. How valuable would it be to have direct access to some of the past guests that I've had on my show to learn exactly how they executed certain strategies to grow their business? I have to believe it would be extremely helpful to your entrepreneurial journey. And as someone who has access to these founders, I can tell you firsthand, it's very helpful, and I want to make it available to you. In fact, that is the experience and knowledge sharing that is delivered to you each quarter when you become a Grindology member. Grindology is an entrepreneurial subscription box that ships every quarter full of resources to help fuel your grind and your hustle. Now, you might be asking, what's included in the Grindology shipment? Well, first and foremost, every single Grindology shipment will include a copy of the Grindology Tactical Manual. Every single issue of Grindology will be chock full of real tactics from real business builders, not journalists. Within the pages of the Grindology Tactical Manual, we will be delivering to you tactics and strategies that you can integrate into your business immediately. How great would it be to receive real Facebook ad strategies from those who are doing it? Wouldn't it be helpful if a successful founder laid out specific user acquisition strategies that they use to grow their business? Well, those are the types of tactics that will be found in each issue of Grindology. Like I said, real tactics from real business builders. In addition to the Grindology Tactical Manual, each shipment delivers two bags of uniquely crafted coffee specifically roasted for you, the founder, the hustler, the entrepreneur, maker, and creator. Each shipment also includes an exclusive mug that speaks to the unique nature that is you, the entrepreneur. Everything about Grindology is about helping to fuel your grind. In fact, that is exactly why our friends at Design Pickle have partnered with us for our first box. Yep, our homies at Design Pickle are hooking up one lucky subscriber with one full year of unlimited graphic design services. That is a $12,000 prize. Like I said earlier, everything I do is about helping you in your entrepreneurial journey. So visit Grindology.com to learn more. Our Q1 box and the chance to win the Design Pickle package valued at close to $12,000 is an exclusive shipment, so make sure to secure your box today at Grindology.com. We'll always include a link in the show notes so you have easy access to Grindology.com. Now let's jump into this week's episode. My guest this week is Ryan Lewinden, partner at the law firm Giannuzzi Lewinden. Now, before you start scrolling to another episode because you really don't want to hear from a lawyer, let me tee this one up for you. See, I get hit up a ton by lawyers and coaches to be on this show, and I mean a ton. I always say no, though, because the startup story of both of those doesn't really appeal to me. But when Ryan's publicist hit me up, she emailed me telling me the value of interviewing this person long before she revealed that he was an attorney. So I was interested. I was already hooked. That said, we will not be discussing Ryan's journey to starting his law firm. We will be talking about all things CPG. And Ryan's experience in this space is immense. He has worked on deals with Vitamin Water, Pirate's Booty, Pretzel Chris, Siggy's Yogurts, Vita Coco, Essential Water, and even Schmidt's Naturals, which you might remember from our interview with Jamie Schmidt shortly after she sold her brand to Unilever. All that to say, Ryan knows a thing or two about the CPG space, and that is the knowledge sharing that is going to take place today. This entire episode is all about the CPG, so let's get started. You have a ton of expertise in the CPG space. You represented some of the most incredible brands out there. And so when it comes to helping my entrepreneurial audience understand what are some trends that you see, I really can't think of a better expert than someone like yourself to understand where we've been and what we're going to see. So can you share with my audience, what are some trends we're going to see in the CPG space?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. Thanks, James. And thanks for having me. You know, the first trend I'd talk about in the year ahead is plant-based, right? That should, like, plant-based, the trend should sort of come as no surprise to everyone. It's something that, you know, for years has been sort of gaining into the public consciousness. You know, Beyond Meat's IPO and now Oatly's IPO has certainly sort of brought to the forefront of business as well as sort of people's dinner plates. Although I will say in the past couple of years, you know, plant-based has, the thoughts around plant-based has sort of shifted from, you know, something you do just to survive to something that you can do to really thrive, right? Yeah. So you've got athletes out there like Tom Brady and Chris Paul who've adopted these plant-based diets and, you know, are crediting it to rejuvenating their athletic careers. So people are sort of, first, they're looking at these diets as something that can really be beneficial to them is in terms of like elongating their life or elongating their athletic careers or really improving where they are. And then you've also got a lot of products out there, a lot of innovation out there that's like developing new and better ways, better tasting ways and better functional ways to get plant-based. So there's companies like Coya, right? Which is plant-based protein shakes, smoothies, other drinkable sort of athletic-based benefits, but it's all plant-based. So before where your options were like Muscle Milk, which was dairy-based, or you know, like a whey protein or an animal protein, this is a plant-based alternative that tastes great and has no sort of animal products in it whatsoever. You also have things like companies like From the Ground Up, right? So that where they've taken traditional plant-based form factors like grains and rice, for things like tortilla chips and pretzels. And they've replaced it with like cauliflower and butternut squash, and it's generally better for you plant-based products. Yeah. So you're finding this proliferation of the plant-based sort of product offerings that are becoming better for you, different form factors, and still great tasting. So I think there's a lot of room to run there in that trend for the upcoming year.
That's interesting.
Thanks.
What else are you seeing?
Yeah. So like one of my personal areas of interest is better for you imbibing, right? So the pandemic, it's obviously given everybody sort of a reason to have a beverage or something to unwind at the end of the day. While we've been working from home and trying to relax from home, you know, you've seen it. Everybody's reaching for a wine glass, working out with the wine bottles, you know, imbibing's been sort of more of a part of our lives in some ways than it has pre-pandemic. But I've also found that, you know, just the pandemic sort of exacerbated some of the trends. So while people are looking to unwind and imbibe, they're also looking for ways to keep themselves healthier and safer while they're doing so. So, you know, looking for things like products that, you know, might be imbibing, but also sort of add benefits. It might be probiotic. It might be a better product. It might be lower calorie, lower sugar. Those are trends that have sort of been trending for the past couple of years, but I think we're accelerated by the pandemic where people are equally as worried about imbibing as they are about their health and keeping their immunity up. So you've got a company like Flying Embers, which offers an array of products like hard kombucha, probiotic seltzer. They came out with a beer that's, you know, low calorie, low carb, low sugar, but also infused with ashwagandha and some other functional type mushrooms to sort of enhance that imbibing experience. People want that sort of multi-factor experience from imbibing these days. In addition, they've got like, in addition to like functional alcohol, people are looking for like no and low ABV ways to unwind. So, you know, that might be something sessionable, meaning that you can drink a lot of them without sort of having a ton of alcohol in there, like a company like House. Or something like with no alcohol, like a hop water or something like a Kin that's got no alcohol in it, but has adaptogens or other things like ashwagandha or GABA or kava that are meant to sort of give you a relaxing mood without sort of the hangover from the alcohol.
You know, it's interesting, just the idea of a healthier drink. I mean, drinking in and of itself is not usually categorized as healthy in any way, shape, or form. And yet we're trying to solve that problem, right? And that's what I love about entrepreneurship is that someone out there thought, I want to keep on drinking. How do I make this healthy? And I love it. Cool. So what's the last trend you're seeing in the CPG space?
Yeah. And just the last point on the healthiness. I don't think any of the imbibing stuff is healthy, but it's healthier for you, right? Yeah. People are looking for degrees of, you know, how can I do less harm to myself, right? How can I minimize the after effects of the good time that I'm having? Yeah. But yeah, I think, look, people want more bang for their buck out of everything. And that would take me in some ways to the sort of last trend. And this trend is a macro trend, I think is going to be one of the biggest and most far reaching for sort of the years ahead. And that's personalized wellness. You know, like over the past years, everybody's looking, like I said, more bang for your buck out of your product, right? People are looking for efficacy. They want, you know, you want CBD and your deodorant to relax you while it's also sort of like helping you smell good after a workout. You know, you want multi-factor things. And people have realized as they're sort of getting more into biohacking that they're considering like their own genome, their biome, and how that interacts with different products. Every consumers have become aware that like not all one size products fit everyone the same or react to everyone the same. So there have become lots more products out there that are more narrowly tailored to people, right? That might like be from taking a blood glucose monitor to help develop like a line of supplements, which is going to help you recover from workout better. It might be something like a company like No Beauty, which is utilizing like your geography, a test about like what your lifestyle is like, and then a genome test to help develop and pair like the right or the best types of skincare regime for you, right? So there's people are using data and analysis, like macro micro data, to help develop more targeted, more efficacious products to consumers. And that's really filling a desire from the consumer end. But as that technology improves, I think that proliferation of products is going to expand. And you know, 20 years from now, basically everything we consume will have some aspect of it that is more narrowly tailored to our specific biome and the way we process things.
It's amazing when you think about data and how it's used, right? I mean, just, you know, last week we had Elizabeth Grogene, the founder of Blue Living, who knew she wanted to create an e-commerce channel, but didn't know what she wanted to sell. And so she leveraged the data that Amazon provides to show what our, you know, search quantities and what's hot, how many providers are there. Like, and she was able to identify weighted blankets as an opportunity, and she's blown up since, right? And so when I think of, you know, our Facebook ads, right? The amount of data Facebook has that we can now cater our advertising to. And then I think of something like 23andMe, which is gathering your DNA, like, and it's a data set. So it's like, I wonder when we have all these various data sets, the things that we can accomplish. Because when I think of the idea of tailored products, right? Whether it be the CBD deodorant or whether it be a certain allergenic free element, a cookie or whatever the case may be. If we have access to what population are experiencing these allergies, we can then create products based on this solution. So it's almost like this Amazon, 23andMe, and then with Facebook knowing who to market to, like it can get extremely tailored and extremely precise.
Oh yeah. I mean, first I think 23andMe in a lot of ways is going to be the backbone of that sort of personalized or like intelligent wellness, just because it's the biggest database that we've got out there of sort of DNA. Right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, as that expands and as that sort of grows, you know, this is going to be the next generation of targeted ads, right? So, you know, hey James, you know, we heard that, you know, you've got you digest, you know, sunflower, you know, not that well, right? Like you don't digest that well. Here's an alternative for you, right? That'll get you the same sort of prebiotic sort of effects, but without all the digestion issues, right? And that's sort of that next generation of targeted ads. The more data like companies can gather on us, and the more sort of, you know, granular they can get, the more sort of targeted they can give us. And you know, from consumer, it does mean sort of more efficacious product offerings, and maybe a little bit less searching and a little less discovery for different products.
Yeah. Yeah.
And getting to that sort of end result that you're looking for a little bit quicker.
That's unbelievable. Unbelievable. I love data. Absolutely love it. So, you know, for those who are in agreement with you that these are some incredible opportunities in the CPG space, or maybe for the listener who is already moving on a CPG brand, what are some advice or tips or tactics you would give to those who are pursuing a startup in the CPG space?
Yeah, you know, so my practice is built working with companies at every stage of the life cycle. And, you know, I've taken a lot of companies basically from when, you know, they were just starting, you know, to all the way, every step of the way through their sale of the company. So I've seen companies, you know, a lot of successful companies like, you know, Vitamin Water and Pirate's Booty and, you know, Happy Baby sort of start and finish. And just from that experience, there's like a number of things almost everybody can do to set themselves up for success when you're a startup. And, you know, the first is launching from a strong foundation, right? There's things like identifying the things you need for your company and the things you don't need, right? Almost universally, if you're in CPG, you're going to need to own your recipe. You're going to need to own your trademark. You're going to need to own your trade dress. And almost universally, there's some things you won't need, right? Like you won't need to own your own manufacturing facility. You won't need to own your own distributor, distribute your products. A lot of that stuff can be outsourced and is outsourced, and the market is outsourcing, right? So knowing what you need and what you don't need, and the stuff that you do need, making sure you have it, right? When you go to your co-packer and you develop your product and you love it, having some delineation that like, oh, this is my recipe. You know, I get to own it. I get to keep it. I get to take it. It's not the manufacturers that I'm just sort of borrowing or licensing. Just making sure you have those things buttoned down, the foundation and the bedrock of your brand, that, you know, when a, you know, a conglomerate goes to buy you or you do an IPO, people are going to be concerned about, you know, your IP, your base IP, and you know, your sort of supply chain, your distribution network, and your manufacturing plans and your marketing plans. Having all that and owning it and having it sort of, you know, from the get-go will set you up for success later on, right? And some of those things, if you don't have it, it's better off, like when you're early, to just start over and restart, right? If you go out and you love a name and you file it, you go out to look at the trademark and there's somebody else with that trademark that's close to it, you're not going to be able to get it. Find something else. Develop another name, right? When you're starting out, find something that's strong and that you can launch on and that you can build on, you can bring investors in, and that you can sort of carry on all the way through. You know, the second thing is to build around your weaknesses early on. Like almost every founder comes from one, you know, product area, right? Like you're either a finance person or a marketing person or an ops person, and they have that set of sort of strengths that they absolutely know up and down. And then they have a lot of weaknesses because they don't have a lot of experience there, right? The marketing person probably doesn't know ops or finance as well as marketing, obviously, and vice versa. You know, so find a team of advisors to put around you, whether that's early employees or whether that's advisors, you know, board advisors or lawyers or consultants or even manufacturing partners, distribution partners. Find somebody who really knows what they're doing in that subset of your business better than you and almost anybody else, and partner with them and, you know, develop, you know, to shore off those issues. Because putting people around you that complement your weaknesses and fill in your weaknesses early on will help you can, you know, avoid lots and lots of missteps early on. And that's the third thing. You know, when you're starting out, you know, you want to contract as carefully as you can. Like when you're small, the little mistakes have big implications on you. When you're small, you know, a small misstep can be crippling to your business. You know, when you're big and you have sort of lots of volume and you have lots of cash behind you and you have a, you know, a cachet and you have a reputation and you have consumer loyalty, make a little mistake here or there, it gets swept under the rug. Yeah. When you're small and you're trying to prove yourself, you know, one misstep, you know, letting one account down, letting, you know, raising money and then, you know, telling you're going to do X, Y, and Z and not being able to deliver, all that stuff can be detrimental and sometimes fatal to your company. So contract very carefully with the people you put around yourself, the people you promise equity to, the people that you bring in initially to help you make the product or distribute it, right? Just be very careful about what you'd agree on early on. You have the least leverage then, and it has the most impact, the far-reaching impact on the company later on. So just enter into those very thoughtfully. You know, the obviously inclination when you're starting out is to rush as fast as you can, but you gotta build those contracts very, very carefully and thoughtfully. You know, the fourth thing to do is honestly practice balance, right? So going back to moving as fast as you can as a founder, you know, you're kind of moving at the speed of commerce. You're running on all cylinders at all time, and that is the founder life. But you know, burnout is real. Founder burnout's real. You know, like I said, I've worked with, you know, over 1,000 companies, you know, from, you know, start to different stages of the life cycle to finish. And you know, this story is a marathon. It's not a sprint. Most founders don't sell their companies within 5 years, right? Most of them sell their companies within, you know, 5 to 10 years or more, right? So you want to make sure that you are maintaining yourself internally, you know, emotionally, physically, as well as growing the business. So taking time out to, You know, meditate, reflect, get your exercise in. That's all as important as sort of, you know, doing your sales calls and doing your initial investor pitches and bringing all those things in. You got to prioritize it so that you don't burn out. And then the last thing, you know, almost all startups can do to sort of position themselves for success is take a time out every once in a while to remember why you're here. Almost every founder started because of some passion, some matter that told them, hey, I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to, you know, take this risk. I'm going to mortgage my house. I'm going to move across the country. I'm going to take this risk to do something disruptive in this world. And there's some motivation behind that, why you made that decision. And it's so easy while you're going through that startup life. You know, it's a life of a lot of no's, right? You're going to hear a lot of no's before you hear yeses. It's easy to get discouraged. It's easy to take lots of advice from people that aren't doing what you've done and say, you know, this is the way to do it. This is the way everybody does it. This is market, right? Lots of people say that in founding. This is what market is. Well, if you're trying to disrupt things, why do you want to do what everybody else is doing, right?
Yeah.
And so taking time to remember why you're here, why you started that, recentering yourself on that passion that got you up out of bed and into this, you know, this journey, making sure you sort of align with that every once in a while will keep you sort of on the right path. So
I love it. And you're absolutely right. I mean, it is, and it is a true marathon. And unfortunately, the media headlines will have you believing it's a field of dreams model where if you build it, they will come. And, you know, you can create an idea and sell within the first 3 years. And it's just not true. And I think a lot of people, they jump into this marathon very much like it's a sprint and you're done within 18 months. But at the same time, as a founder, we are very, we're very optimistic about what our startup's going to be. Our startup is going to be the disruptor of the industry. Our startup is going to be the next, you know, insert brand here, Apple, Google, whatever the case may be, Uber, Tesla, you know, we're going to be huge, right? And so, you know, a lot of times we start with an exit in mind already, right? Whether that exit be a sale or whether it be an IPO, partially because when we're pitching the venture, VCs want to know what's the exit plan. Like that's in their mind, that's where the money comes from, right? So it's like, great. Then, you know, and that actually, let me step back. That's not all venture. Steve Jurvetson had on the show, one of the early investors of Tesla and SpaceX, says that is a question he never asks, because more times than not, people are playing the short game. And for him, if you have an answer for an exit in 7 to 10 years, then your idea is not big enough, and I'm not interested. And I love his perspective. He's like, don't come to me with an exit plan within 5 to 10 years. He's like, I'm looking at something that's 25, 30 years down the road. That's how big and audacious your problem and solution is. But for our founders who are in this CPG space, since that's what we're focusing on for this episode, you know, what would you suggest to them from a preparation now? In the beginning for a future exit, whenever that may be?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a few things to do here, James, that almost everybody in CPG can do. So first, when you're preparing to sell your brand, you know, if you're, let's say you're 2 years out or more, one thing you wanna start thinking about is making sure you've got enough runway to carry through the sale, right? Because look, not only do you want to sell the company, you want to sell it successfully, and you want to sell it as a big win for you and your current shareholders and your current investors and all that, right? And one of the biggest defeats in terms of doing that for yourself is running out of money along the way through a sale, right? So make sure you're well enough capitalized. You know, companies that have sort of runway for, you know, a year, 18 months, you know, like when they're negotiating a sale, they don't have to make concessions. They don't get taken advantage of. The leverage of the buyer, you know, doesn't impose on them. It's a lot of times when people are looking at a sale, they say, okay, I'm at a sale, you know, I'm not going to need more money. I'll just stop on the fundraising side. I'll focus on the sale. And they get really low in cash reserves. And when you're at the closing table and you're coasting on fumes and the buyer wants to sort of add a couple different clauses, sometimes you have to take those things. So first thing is make sure you've got enough runway to carry you through the sale. And ideally, if the sale doesn't go through, to continue on sort of next steps for the company, you know, re-up, replan, regroup, and then go back out there. Another thing you can do to help put you in success for selling your brand in the future is do a diagnostic. Do a self-diagnostic about the company. look for any issues, look for any loose ends, and tie those up ahead of time. You know, it is one thing. A lot of founders think, hey, look, I'm going to sell my company. The buyer is going to take these problems. They'll fix them. It'll be somebody else's problem. It'll be fine. And that very may well be the case. But if you have issues in your supply chain, in your trademark, and, you know, in your company in general, a lot of times the buyers will deduct that from purchase price, right? They will penalize you for some of those issues. Or sometimes, depending on what the problem is, it might scare them away completely. So do a pre-sale diagnostic. Go in, look at your company top to bottom. Look at my workforce. Look at my IP. Look at my agreements with my distributors, my brokers, my manufacturers, right? Make sure that like my top executives are all sort of, you know, aligned and incentivized, right, with the company. Make sure all of that's tight. Because, you know, what you're really doing with CPG companies, you're selling sort of a bundle of assets, right? Your workforce, your IP, your actual inventory, but also your distribution network. And each layer of that's got to be sort of in great shape in order to complete a sale. So taking, you know, 2 years ahead of time, focusing on those issues, you know, taking the time out of your schedule to do that, that's going to put you in a much better position for success later on down the road.
Love it. Love it.
Third thing you can do to really set yourself up for success is identify what you want your role to be going forward as the founder. You know, a lot of founders think, hey, look, I want my role to be on a beach somewhere, you know, far away from the company after I sell. And that's totally fine if that's the case. But a lot of times a company, when they buy you, are going to need to know that. They're going to want to know that. And the attractiveness of buying the company or not is going to depend a lot of times on what the founder's involvement is going to be. You know, a lot, especially big companies, they're not great at moving quick. And a lot of times they might want you to stay on for 18 months at a minimum to sort of help transition things. So you have to decide before you get down the sale process, what do I want from the rest of my life, right? Can I keep doing this for 5 years? Am I interested in sort of being the innovation arm at a big conglomerate? Do I want out of this completely? Decide who you want to be after you exit in relation to your brand and sort of map that out. And that's gonna help you do the last thing you can do that'll put you for success, and that's identify the perfect potential partner, right? And that's before you process. That's before you do a process. That's before you start speaking to people. Start identifying in your mind the potential, perfect potential partner to sell your business to, right? Is it, you know, is it a multinational conglomerate? Is it a smaller sort of a company that loves to, you know, grow profitable companies? Is it a company that's got, you know, lots of internal sort of beneficial social programs? What would be the best fit for your brand, your product, from your brand ethos and, you know, the type of product and, you know, the workforce, and start developing that separately in your mind. And then when you're closer to sale, you can take those categories or that makeup of your perfect potential sort of sale partner, and you can look and you can say, all right, well, who's out there that identifies with these things? Who's out there that could be the match? That's going to help you identify people that could be a seamless, easy transition, both from sort of a philosophical standpoint of the brand, but also sort of a nuts and bolts kind of product side of the brand. And if you already have that thought out, it's going to help you sort of parse through all the potential bad suitors. Because when you go to sell your brand, I mean, the distraction of selling your brand and running your brand at the same time is a mess, right? If you can sort of, you know, parse through the potential dead ends a lot easier, it's going to help that process exponentially.
Oh my goodness. What value. But, you know, I want to ask a bonus question, if you will, you know, one that, you know, I know sometimes a lot of founders, we hear about following the roadmap of someone ahead of us, right? We hear about, you know, follow the blueprint that another brand has set before us. But when it comes to entrepreneurship, man, like it's such a squirrely journey. Like it is, you know, the smallest of variables can change the game greatly. And I'm asking a question where I know there truly is no answer to, but from your experience, you know, what are some metrics that a CPG brand needs to be cognizant of to even be appealing to for an acquisition. And I ask this question from the standpoint of, you know, and again, I know there's no right answer to this, but there's ideas that we could help our listeners understand. Is it distribution? How many stores are you in? How many countries are you selling to? What are your other channels? Is it a brand equity decision? How much brand equity do you have in the space, and how do you measure that? And then, you know, how much of the supply chain do you own internally? Are you cooking it yourself versus an external? Like, what are the things from your experience? Again, your experience with the brands that you've helped go through from beginning to exit. What are some things that will make a brand of high target value for an acquisition?
Yep. Yeah. Oh, that's a great question. And obviously there's a lot of different factors and it differentiates, but here's a couple of factors that sort of, I do think permeate throughout CPG. So from a financial aspect, you know, I think the trends in the past few years in CPG have been both a focus on top line and bottom line, right? There was a time 10, 8 years ago, you could sell your company if you had enough market share, enough velocity and growth, top line, nobody really worried about the bottom line. That has changed in the past couple of years, and acquirers want either profitability to some extent, or they want some pathway to profitability, right? The times of sort of the big dollar amounts for sort of companies that had never shown how they're going to make money, I think that's gone for now. The public markets might change that, but we can debate that on another on another show. At least in terms of CPG infrastructure and the market for sort of like selling to a CPG conglomerate, they want to see some type of profitability or some pathway to profitability. Mm. The second part is just like internal culture, your company culture. I would find that, you know, in CPG, especially better for your CPG, like having a great team and a great company culture and a company culture that sort of stands for something and where people are sort of a great amount of people are motivated and aligned towards a common cause and finding a way to sort of build that and develop that. That's something almost every buyer is going to is looking for, is going to be impressed by, and is going to be very meaningful to them when they acquire the company. More and more these days in CPG, when a conglomerate is buying a company, they're also looking to buy the team, right? You're rarely seeing a brand bought and all the employees be sort of let go after the purchase. More and more of these CPG conglomerates see a vertical, they see a team, they see, you know, they see the internal culture and they see what was built at Common Cause. They try to keep that as much as possible and integrate that into the system because they know it's hard to replicate. And, you know, a lot of founders in CPG, that's one of the things, at least with my clients that I work with, I think they're really, really great at. And the third is just execution, right? An acquirer wants to see that you've had a plan and you've been able to execute on it, right? And that's so simple and so pedantic.
Yeah.
But it's also so difficult. Like when you're a disruptive brand, there's almost no way to forecast what you're doing, right? Whether it's on a big scale or a little scale, it's so hard because you're doing something that almost nobody's done before, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, not saying you got to hit the mark exactly, but seeing a pattern where, hey, I had a vision for this, I had a plan about this, and I was able to just more or less hit plan, that's something that's going to be impressive to a buyer community. That's something that's going to be impressive to a conglomerate. I mean, I'll say, you know, one of my clients, Vitamin Water, their founder, Mike Rapoli, sat me down in his office in Whitestone, Queens, like, I don't know, 7 years ago, you know, when Vitamin Water probably had, Body Armor had almost no, like, portion of the sports drink, you know, market share. And he sat down, he said, this is the presentation. This is what I'm going to do next year. This is what we're doing in the year after that. This is what we're doing the year after that. This is what we're doing the year after that. This is our product line. These are our line extensions. This is why accounts want us. This is why they'd rather, you know, sell our product than competitors. And literally, not exactly the numbers, but like almost everything he said He didn't came true. Like, Mike Capoli's an executor. He executes like almost nobody. My friend Josh Zad, who owns Alfred Coffee and Cali Dad Beer, you know, his execution, he went from having a business plan to a product, to completing a fundraise, to completing a launch in maybe like 6 months, right? Which in terms of time for launching CPG products is only no amount of time. And because of that, he's developed so much faith and he's developed such a great fan base. He's great, like an internal following. Just being able to execute, to tell people you're gonna do something, and you know, maybe you don't do it the exact way you said you were going to, but you find a way to get comparably there. Doing that over and over and over again is one of the things almost any founder, any CPG brand can do over and above anything else that's gonna breed success.
I love it. Thank you so much for joining us on the Startup Story.
Of course, James, thanks so much for having me.
Once you've had a few moments to process all the value that Ryan Lewinden brought us in this week's episode, please hit me up on LinkedIn, Facebook, or Instagram and share with me your thoughts on this episode. In fact, if you're in the CPG space, it might be wise of you to reach out to Ryan to see if there's anything you might need to button up before your brand hits the big time. You can reach out to him via his firm's website at glaw.us. And if you've been around the Startup Story for any length of time, then you know how much emphasis I put on the idea that entrepreneurs support other entrepreneurs. So let's show up for Ryan Lewinden in a huge way by visiting glaw.us or sharing his firm's URL in a LinkedIn post. Based on how large the CPG market is, I'm pretty sure we are all connected to someone in the CPG space. And we all know how challenging brand awareness can be, so let's show up for Ryan in this way. And now for my personal ask.
The Startup Story community has been so incredible about sharing our podcast with others, but we have more stories to tell and more people to reach. We too are a startup, and word of mouth is everything. So please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Startup Story, or on Twitter at Startup Story _. If you're on LinkedIn, please search for The Startup Story and follow our company page. LinkedIn is a really powerful way to raise awareness of the show. But the most impactful way you can help us grow our audience is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Or if you listen to the show via Spotify, then please simply share the podcast directly from your Spotify app or wherever you listen to the show. These simple actions can make a huge impact in getting these amazing founder stories out to the masses. And please make sure to tag or mention the Startup Story when you do share so that we can connect with you and say thank you directly. I'm so incredibly appreciative of the fact that you listen to the show each and every week. And I look forward to sharing these amazing stories with you every Tuesday with hopes of encouraging and inspiring you to start your story.